Thanks for listening to the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. You can contact the show at twitter.com/DW Groovecast and through Facebook at facebook.com/Drummer's Weekly Groovecast.
Good evening.
I am warning you right now, if you touch my drums, I will stab you in the neck with a knife.
Ain't a fucking. Ain't a fucking.
Mom!
Take it easy. Lower it.
I'm not gonna lower it. I have to do this now.
I don't mind playing it, but lower it.
Well, we gonna straighten out?
No, we had a problem. I mean, we tried to do everything we could.
What do you mean?
Well, you know what I mean.
Next! A little trouble there. You're rushing.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Yeah!
Hello there, folks. Phil here from the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. Happy Monday to everyone, and welcome back to part two of the Ryan Brown interview. We'd like to not only welcome our regular weekly listeners, but also extend a nice warm welcome to all of the Zappa fans that are out there. We know that you guys like to travel and listen en masse, so we appreciate all of the traffic that you've been giving us in all the nice response from part one of the interview. We're not going to take a lot of time getting into it today other than to say, again, thank you for listening. And if you would like to reach out to us, our email account is drummersweeklygroovecast@gmail.com. Our Facebook account is facebook.com/drummersweeklygroovecast. And you can always tweet us at twitter.com/DW Groovecast. We publish a new show every single Monday. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us on Google Play Podcasts. You can find us on Stitcher, Podbean. You can ask your Alexa on TuneIn to find us. Or you can just do it the old-fashioned way and subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app. If you can't find us, let us know because we're out there and readily available. All right, so here we go with part two of the Ryan Brown interview. Now, one of the things, and we're delaying the Zappa stuff right now. trust me, guys, we're going to get to this. We're going to spend some time on it. But one of the things that I've read about you is you have quite a studio resume as well. You've done some studio stuff.
Well, thanks. So when I moved to LA, my whole thing was I want to be studio guy. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be road guy. I want to be in LA. I want to do studio stuff. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my big reasons for wanting to study with Kenny, because he was doing, you know, tons and tons of session work. And he helped me with that immensely, trying to get in the mindset of doing the session thing and how to do it, how to hear a song one time and then play it back immediately after you've only listened to it one time. And this is a great thing for everybody to practice at home. Pick any song, listen to it, figure out a way to make some quick chart of it, and then do like a fake session with yourself. Uh-huh. And then give, you know, or have a buddy do it with you and give yourself instruction, you know, record it and be like, okay, that was cool. Maybe do a different fill going into the second chorus, and the fill going out of the bridge wasn't very good. Try that one again, but do the same fill going into the outro. Like putting yourself in mock session scenarios.
Great advice.
So, I mean, that's for me, learning how to chart stuff quickly is probably one of the most valuable assets that I think any drummer or any musician can have. And I got a lot of that from Kenny. And then one thing, I thought of this, I need to mention this too, when I moved there, another thing that I did is I joined the Musicians Union, and I got the union book, and I called all of my favorite drummers and asked them if they taught lessons. So when I moved there, I was only there for like a couple of weeks. I joined there and I called Bizanette, Weckl, Vinny, Keltner, like you name it, like Kurt Becerra, yeah. Joe Porcaro, Alex Acuna, Tom Brechtlein. I mean, like, I literally went through the Union book and was like, okay, I have nothing going on. This is the perfect time to try to take lessons from these guys, even if it's one lesson. And Kenny was, you know, throwing me some auditions on the side, and maybe one of these guys might have some work he can't do or something that doesn't pay enough. You know, maybe, you know, whatever, Tom Brechtlein doesn't, it gets called for a gig and he's like, I'm not going to do it. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't pay enough because he's at this amazing level. Maybe, you know, he'll throw some stuff my way. You never know what's going to happen. So of all those guys I called, you'd be surprised the number of them that actually called me back, even though I was just a kid who just moved to LA. And I will say, when Jim Keltner called me back,
oh my gosh,
it was one of the craziest moments ever. And it's also a testament to how nice almost all these guys are. That like they're all crazy busy and they're on the road, all right. the time. And Bizanet called me back from the road. He was like, I'm on the road right now, but do you know this drummer, Mark Craney? I did not know who Mark was. He was like, Mark's a great friend of mine. You need to go study with him. When I get back, I'd love to teach you.
Right.
So then he introduced me to Mark, and that was a whole other thing. Before I forget, I thought of that. That was a whole other eye-opening experience right when I got there.
Great story, man. That's wonderful. Now, I wanted to go, you've already alluded that you called a lot of these guys that were especially known for studio work.
Yeah.
Now, I think everybody is well aware that in today's music climate, the studio scene it's still there, but it's of course not what it was,
right.
You know, at one time. Do you stay in contact, or do you have any relationship with any of those folks, you know, that you'd rattled off some of the names, and some of the others I'm going to throw out there also are like some guys like John Robinson or yeah. Denny Fonghiser.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, any of those guys that were known primarily for doing a lot of studio stuff. Ndugu Chancellor also.
Yeah.
Right. Any contact with those folks? Or
yeah, I've never met Ndugu, but JR, uh-huh. I've met a bunch of times. And Denny, I've met a couple times doing rock and roll fantasy camps.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. And both those guys are super nice guys. The session thing. So here's my take on it. You can do anything on your laptop in your apartment, and anybody can, but you can't record drums.
Right.
So my experience and I still do a ton of session stuff when I'm in LA all the time. Very lucky to still get called for a lot of that. What a lot of people I know do is they will write songs, record songs at their house. Producers, songwriters will, and they'll save up until they've got a batch of like 10,
uh-huh.
and then they'll call the drummer and go into a real studio and cut drums. So. From my standpoint, drummers still, there's still a lot of session work because there's a lot of amazing programs that drum programs that sound real.
Right.
But there's nothing like that feel of having a real drummer play on your track. And I do it all the time still. So now I've talked with guitar player friends and bass player friends, and for that not happening as much because, you know, people can kind of piece together in their apartment a guitar right. part, or piece together a bass part, drums. Most people still use real drummers.
You're giving people hope, man.
that's what happens when I'm back there. Like that's still, you know, it's not false hope. That is what happens for me when I'm there. Like that's what goes down. So I wanted to be session guy.
Yeah.
And I got offers for auditions, and I would do auditions just to do auditions. That's right. Another great, you know, great thing actually for us to mention is if there's an audition, just do it. Even if yeah. you don't want the gig, it doesn't matter. Even if you get it and you turn it down, who cares? Just do it just to get audition experience, just to, yeah. you know, go through the process of learning songs quickly. Are you going to get butterflies? You know, how are you going to feel in that moment? So then when the audition comes that you do want, you're ready for that.
Yeah.
You're ready, you know, to after doing, you know, any kind of auditions, or get your friends together and do fake auditions.
Yeah.
And do fake sessions. You know, I have students that do that kind of a thing, which is a great thing to do.
Man, great advice.
Just so when you get to that place, like I said, you've already done it. So you're in that different headspace.
Yeah.
Than, oh my God, I've never done this before and I want to play with, you know, what, you know, whatever band. Incubus is looking for a new drummer or whatever, and they're my favorite band in the world. And, but it's no big deal because you've already done all these auditions.
Right.
So my thing, excuse me, with the session stuff was, I started playing and I started getting gigs working around town, but I also have always been all about having an original band and being an original band, because that's why I started playing music, because I like playing original music also.
Yeah.
And there was a band I got in early on in LA in 01 called Owl. And the leader of the band was this guy, Chris Wise, who's a phenomenal bass player who played in the band The Cult for about 15 years. He's now on the road with Ace Frehley, and he's done a million sessions with all these people and Bob Rock and all this stuff. So the way I get into it, and my advice for anybody, is just get in an original band, and eventually there's going to be a producer for that band. And eventually that producer's going to do some other stuff and they'll call you. And that's what happened to me, is I got in this band Owl and we started playing all the time. And there was a producer named Michael Reed, who I met in 01, and I was at his house a couple months ago.
Yeah.
I still go to his house all the time. He has a killer setup at his drum tracking setup at his house. And he at the time had a publishing deal with Disney. And so it's kind of like a combination of like being in a major city where like a producer could potentially have a production deal with other companies or other people, being an original band where a producer could find that band. And then we would do Owl sessions. Then one day he said, you know what, I've got all this other stuff. Would you want to come do it? I was like, hell yeah, I want to do it. So I went and did it, and that was the first like actual CD I could go into a store and buy was for a Disney movie called Xenon Z3.
Cool.
Michael said, I'll get you a copy. I was like, no, I want to go to Tower and buy it. I was like, yeah. I want to go buy the first one. So then kind of parlayed into a producer named Marty Fredrickson, which parlayed into all these other guys, which ended up being all the session stuff, including, I'm very lucky, a few gold records, which that those days might be done now.
Right.
But it was all just from playing in an original rock band and then just having guys call you to do other work.
Man, that is the first time that I have ever heard that specific advice regarding studio sessions. You need to patent that, man. That's the first time I've ever, but it makes total sense. It makes complete sense, man. So yeah, great. Now, a few things about studio sessions in particular. Are there particular pieces of gear that you like for sessions that would, say, vary from a live gig? That you know, there's certain things you must have.
Wow, that's a great question. So for sessions, you can pretty much never bring too much stuff. And I slowly would just start amassing this collection of snare drums. It's like first thing when I moved to LA, I had one snare drum. And then you go to a session and someone would say, hey, do you have, you know, a Black Beauty? No, I didn't, you know. Mm-hmm. So then, I probably shouldn't say this, but I would do this. I would go to Guitar Center. I would buy one.
I know where this is going.
I would use it on the session.
Yeah.
And then take it back to Guitar Center the next day after the session.
Yeah.
And they knew what I was doing, you know. And I've talked to a bunch of people that did this. Not that I'm advocating doing this, but you know what? Eventually you keep it,
right?
You know, eventually, you know, clearly it's not a rent to own situation. I'm not advocating that. But if you have friends that have something like in my situation now, my lockout that I share with my friend Kevin, we have all the stuff and we use each other's stuff all the time.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, and I'm on the road a lot. So and I'm like, dude, use it. And, you know, if it's not, you know, it's not there just to collect dust.
Right.
So, to your question, it's like maple, or let's even to be less specific, a wood drum, mm-hmm. maybe of two different depths, like, you know, shallow, sort of deep, a brass drum, yeah. a steel shell drum, And they all sound completely different. And as you get older, you start to hear those differences more and more and more, you know, like anything. You know, when I first moved to LA, I remember thinking like, why the hell do I need a steel shell and a brass shell drum? And why do I need these depths? And now I'm like, oh my God, how did I not realize that? But you get older and you start to see the light and hear the differences and all these things. So snare drum selection, mm-hmm. massive. Cymbal selection, massive. Different cymbals for a jazz session than a rock session. If I'm going to go do a hard rock record, I'm not taking my 13-inch hi-hats and all my 16-inch crash cymbals. So knowing what to take, and then for as far as a kit standpoint, for me, I figured out more it's about how to tune. It's, you know, because it's hard for any of us. Like I saw the kind of car you have. I have a Toyota Highlander. Like I can't fit three bass drums and, you know, 10 toms in my car. It just is impossible unless you have a cartage company, you know, like mm-hmm. Kenny and, you know, JR and all these guys have cartage companies, move their stuff. But if you're not at that point, I figured out, okay, I'll take like maybe a couple of choices of heads.
There you go.
And then, you know, if it's like a Motown-y thing, I'll tune it different from, mm-hmm. you know, if it's a hard rock thing and if it's a jazz thing. So you get really good at kind of tweaking stuff to make it sound differently, muffling, gaff tape, blankets, you know, making. So in my experience, there's ways to make kick and toms adapt to what you need them. It's way harder with snare drums and it's impossible with cymbals.
Cymbals are cymbal. Yeah. Once you've got it, you got it.
Yeah. So, so I would, you know, my suggestion would be, you know, slowly, it's just how I did it, slowly start to get, you know, a different, you know, you don't have a 19-inch crash, ask for one for Christmas.
Right.
You know, you only have 14-inch hi-hats, you know, put aside a little money and get a set of 13-inch hi-hats. So to try, and you said it perfectly, a cymbal's a cymbal. It's like, like you can kind of make everything, even snare drums, you can kind of make them sound a different way, but cymbals, you can't.
Right.
Like you're stuck.
Yeah, the old thing, guys will be like, you know, I'm going to change this thing. I'm going to put rivets in it. I don't like the way it sounds. Well, now you got a cymbal that doesn't sound good that's got rivets in it. You know, this is essentially what it is.
Exactly, yeah.
So, okay, so you're in the studio. You got the gear cover now, all right? Now, one of the things that we love talking about on this show, in fact, we've dedicated two or three shows to different aspects of this. Let's talk about playing to a click. Okay, because I've used this many times on the show that back when I was even in graduate school in the 90s, if someone had told me at that time that not only every session I would do in the studio, of course, would use a click, but virtually all my live gigs now are done to a click or some sort of sequences or something like that, I would have said, man, you're out of your mind.
Yeah.
But of course, it's a given now that anybody who plays anything, you better be ready to play with a click. So I want to ask you in the studio, when you get in there, what do you like to hear regarding a click? And what I mean by that is, do you have particular tones or sounds that you like? And then also talk to us about click subdivisions. In other words, like quarter note click, eighth note click, blah, 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 that type thing.
Yeah, no, definitely. So I'm with you. I would have said you're out of your mind. Like if I need to do that, you know, and I remember being 12 and people, you know, saying, are you practicing to a metronome? Better practice to a metronome. I remember thinking, oh, whatever. No, practice to a metronome. So every like corporate band gig I do in LA, which is a lot of stuff when I'm in town, is all to track. So it's all to click, just like what you said. Every session, for the most part, is to a click. Or the other thing, if they want like a more of a live feel, what sometimes people will do is you'll start with a click and then they'll yank it at like the first chorus. They'll just pull it out. But you have to play to it at the beginning. The Zappa gig here is like basically one of the only gigs I do that's not to a click. Because it'd be basically impossible to do this to a click.
Right. Do you ever start tunes just to get a tempo?
I do. I have a Tamiya Rhythm Watch to my left, and I have a program for the show, and I don't listen to it, but I look at the lights. And Greg Bizanet, I use the term song starter one day, and I like that a lot. So he, like, I'll look down at it. Like, if you ever see a show, you know, like, I'll kind of like look down, and I'm looking at the lights, and I'll start drumming on my leg. Uh-huh. And I got that from Weckl when I saw him play with the Electric Band when I was 16 on the Beneath the Mass tour. And I've read where he got it from, Steve Gadd. So I'll start playing, you know, while Dweezil's talking or whatever gig I'm doing, whoever the band leader is talking, I'm already playing the song, looking down at the metronome or if it is to a click, hearing it. So when we count it off, I'm already in it.
Right.
So that's a big thing with sessions for me is I'm already playing, I'm already feeling it before I even count it off. So it's not cold. Subdivisions on that massive deal that I did not realize for a long time. The first place I read it was an interview with Pat Mastalotto, who's one of my favorite drummers. And he was talking about recording and putting like drum machine loops in place of a click. And then I recently, a few months ago, took a lesson from Dave Maddox, one of my all-time favorite drummers, and he talked about that for a long time as well. He was like, I never go in and record just to a straight click. He has a drum machine program, and he'll say, hey, what BPM is this song? 116. Is it a shuffle feel or a straight feel? Straight feel. So he pulls it up in his drum machine, and then we'll load it into the session. And he was like, it takes 5 minutes. And he was like, then the song feels way better. So I got into that kind of through those guys, and both those guys have played on records of one of my all-time favorite bands, XTC, one of my my favorite things to listen to in the world. But the subdivisions thing is huge, like having some sort of accent pattern. It's different for everybody, I've found. So if you kind of experiment with it or put a click on at 120 and play a groove to it for 20 minutes or something, and then leave it at 120, but add in like an eighth note subdivision and see what it does to your playing.
Right.
And like, it's a drastic difference. And then do that for 20 minutes and then do it at 119.
Right. And it's funny, isn't it, that you can play a tempo for a certain period of time or play a certain song, you know, that everybody knows that the tempo is going to be 120. Yeah. And then how different it can feel, man, one BPM off. It is astounding, man.
Drastic.
You know?
Yeah.
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 Interesting, man. So last thing we'll wrap up on the studio sessions is, do you have any particular, like, we'll call them like bullets of wisdom? In other words, any specific studio tips that you would like to give to anybody before we move on?
My thing would be what I mentioned a little bit earlier is charting songs. So practice charting songs as fast as you can. If you've never done it before, it's going to be really hard. Mm-hmm. So just pick a song you know, pick a song you know really well, and listen to it and act like you're in a session and grab a sheet of paper and figure out some way to translate what you're hearing into a sheet of paper in one listen, no stops. So start with something easy, like, you know, I mentioned Back in Black earlier. Put on Back in Black or, you know, what is something that's not correct. Like a good song I use teaching beginner students is that Hoobasnank song, The Reason. Mm-hmm. Like, put on something that there's not a lot of crazy stuff going on and figure out how long is every section of the song. What are the sections? What's the form of the song? How many bars long is each section? And as long as you have a roadmap and you can guide yourself through it, you're golden.
Right.
So for me, it's if I know the form, I'm good. The parts, I can fake my way through the parts. Like, you can. Like, we've done this for a long time. Even if you haven't played for a while, you can fake your way. You have a good ear. You can listen. But I can't fake my way through a 9-bar bridge.
Right.
I can't fake my way through a 6-bar pre-chorus, but then the second pre-chorus is 5 bars.
Right.
So as long as I'm counting, and I do this thing I got from a Steve Smith video. You can't see it, but where you count the knuckles in your fingers. It's like an Indian way of counting. That's how I always count.
Yeah.
And just figure out a way to count numbers of bars and practice, and then do like little fake sessions. And that also, again, is great practice for auditions and gigs. Like, you have a gig. We both had this happen to us a bunch of times. We're like, you have a gig and, you know, God forbid some emergency happens and you need a sub and you call me and you're like, Ryan, I have an original set of music tonight at the Variety. It's 10 songs. And you know, what time is it? It's 3:00 right now. The gig's at 8:00. You gotta learn 10 songs by 8:00. Can you do it? figure out a way to do it.
Man, great advice. And I'm guessing that when you talk about your own charts, so to speak, that they mean, I always like to tell people, the charts that I do for me mean more to me than they would for another player, from a standpoint of like, I've got these charts set out a certain way where I know what they mean because I'm doing them quickly. Writing them out quick. I'm, like you said, I'm getting phrases. I'm getting, you know, this is how long this bridge is. And there's a little difference when you go to this course. There's a hit here, blah, 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 that type thing. So we're not talking about these beautifully perfect charts. You know, we're talking about things that are going to mean more to us as individual players.
Definitely. Right. Definitely. And when I teach my own way of doing it, which my way is, I like to say it's 50% Kenny Aronoff's way, 25% Greg Bissonette's way that he showed me, and 25% my own tweaks on what just made more sense to me from both of theirs.
Yeah.
So when I show people, I'm like, this is not the end all by any stretch of the imagination. This is how I do it. And if something else makes more sense, do it your way. Because you're right, because it goes down fast. Like, you know, one lesson. And then I tell people this all the time. This happens routinely. I'll go do a session and there's like three people in the room talking. Hey, how's it going? Do you play golf today? Oh, that's cool. Meanwhile, I'm trying to chart out a song. So then there's that like X factor. I'm not kidding. Like, it sounds like I'm making it up, but I'm not. Like, I've done that. And then the song will end and they'll look at me and they're like, oh, cool. Yeah. I had, a 3-under handicap, whatever. Cool. Ryan, you ready to play a song? And in my head, I'm thinking, it'd have been really nice if you guys didn't talk the whole time I was trying to chart this out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't, but I love the challenge of it.
Yeah.
And I don't, and I'm not going to let them down. And so, and I sort of have, you know, have become known in my small circle of people, somebody who can chart out stuff quickly. So I love the challenge of being like, oh yeah, you know, I'll listen to you guys talk about golf and chart out this crazy song.
Sure. But, great advice, man. One thing that I'm noticing just in this short amount of time that we've spent together here is that even in all of your performance aspect, you still have a teacher's mindset. You know, you really do, man. And I mean that in the best possible way. I mean, because it's obvious that you have had some good teachers in your past. And therefore, I mean, we as performers and we as teachers as well, we only teach what we know, right? And what we've been taught. So, man, that's excellent advice, man. Just wonderful.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. What you made me think of one more thing, actually, when you just said that, just for people to practice. And this, I got this from Joey Heredia, who's another one of my favorite drummers. I took some lessons from him, and this was like a mind-blowing thing for me, and it's amazing for live, but especially studio, is act like you have a mixing board in your head when you're playing, and there's a knob that's hi-hat, a knob that's bass drum, a knob that's snare drum, rack one, rack two, so on. And when you play, constantly mix yourself and think, okay, if I'm the lead singer right now, am I playing too much hi-hat? Yeah, maybe I'll bring only the hi-hat down.
Right.
So practice playing, pick a groove. It doesn't even matter. Play whatever groove with a metronome and then think, okay, hi-hat louder, and then play for a minute. Bass drum softer, but only bass drum.
Right.
Snare drum louder. Like, that kind of stuff is massive to me.
Yeah.
You said I've great teachers. I thought of Joey in that immediately because that was another huge thing for me. But thank you. Oh, I appreciate that.
Oh, man, you're absolutely welcome. So we've teased these folks long enough. There's a lot of people that are they're listening so they can just hear what we're going to talk about next. I hear you have a little gig with a fellow whose last name is Zappa.
I do, also known as my dream gig. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Let's talk about that now.
Yeah.
Okay. We've kind of gotten everything established. We've got a good timeline for, you know, where you started from and kind of where we're up to today. And so one of the first things I want to talk about is let's talk about the gear you're using for this, because we as drummers, most of us, we love gear. And anybody who knows the music that you play knows that there's a good variety of, you got to have some things to be able to carry off this music. So tell us what you're playing tonight.
Well, it's the smallest drum set that I can have to pull the stuff off like the record.
Right. Yeah.
Which is still so much stuff I can't fit it all in my car.
Well, quick question. So, do you have a tech that helps you with this stuff?
I do. Uh-huh. And I will say it's the only time I've ever had a tech, and having a drum tech is the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Chris Del Nostro is his name, and he's amazing. He also texts for Marco Miniman and some other guys.
Oh, well, then you have a small setup then, I guess, compared to, So, hey, look, anybody who schleps our gear around, man, we're massive fans of you. So big shout out to Chris there for that, right?
Dude, yeah. Amen. Yeah, like to be able to walk in, and again, this is the only gig I've ever had like this in my life, and I just turned 40.
Uh-huh.
And to be able to walk in and sit down and play and finish and leave is amazing. Yeah.
Do you help him set up any at all, or do you just literally walk in and you're like, here it is, I just have to fine tune some things?
Well, that's a funny question. So here's what happened. Uh-huh. When I got the gig, because I'm so used to like everybody listening to everybody that plays, I've done it my whole life. So first gig we do, we finish the gig and I help him break down, and he's really nice. He's like, I can do it. I'm like, okay, you know, whatever. I'm just used to doing it. So second gig, I help him. Third gig, I help him. Fourth gig, it's about fourth, fifth gig, something like that. One of the funniest things ever. He grabs me. He's like, Ryan, let me explain something to you. I was like, yeah. And he says, okay. So if Dweezil sees you tearing down the gear, he might think that you'll do it yourself. And you don't want to do it yourself. And I don't want to lose my job. So get away.
yeah, that's good, man. And the other part is you're holding me up, Ryan.
Yeah,
you're,
yeah. You know, plus, like, we all have our own system.
Yeah,
and his system is different from mine. Yeah, and so essentially, get off the riser and walk away. And I was like, okay, and that was the last time I tried. It wasn't for lack of me trying to help him.
Yeah. So tell us about this gear you're playing right now.
Yeah. So I have the smallest kit to pull this stuff off. So I have roto toms on my left, 6, 8, 10 rotos, because there's a lot of Zappa stuff that Frank wrote with bongos.
Yeah.
And then Vinny used a lot of roto toms.
Yeah. Are you using black dots on those?
So I'm an Evans guy. Uh-huh. So I have a black chrome dots on those. They're kind of like a pinstripe sort of equivalent, but they sound amazing. All the Evans stuff is incredible. So black chromes on the roto, so 6, 8, 10, and then toms, 10, 12, 13 racks, 16, 18 floors with, clear Evans G2s on them. They sound killer. And it's all DW Collector's Series Maple, and the kit I actually have had for over 10 years, but when I bought it, and it's a 22 inch kick. And it was the kick 10, 12, 14, 16. So I don't have the 14 with me. I had DW drill legs into the 16. It was a hanging rack tom. And I had them add on when I got this gig, the 13 and the 18.
Mm-hmm.
And John Good is amazing at DW. He was like, bring up your kit. So I took the kit up to DW and he, you know, gets them out, looks at the serial number and everything and made them so they exactly match. You can't, and the fun fact of the day is it's champagne sparkle finish and they don't do sparkles. It's all glass glitters and they didn't do champagne sparkle anymore. So he had to go on a wild goose chase to try and find it. And he found it and he called me. He said, Ryan, I found it, but only enough to do two more. You're going to get the last two champagne sparkle drums that DW ever makes. And I'd asked him about maybe doing a matching snare drum and he was like, I can't, sorry. So I have the third, my 13 and my 18 are the final champagne sparkle drums.
So you champagne sparkle players out there, pound sand, buddy. You're not getting any more of those. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I use an EMAD on the kick.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a sampling pad that I use for cowbells, a lot of cowbell stuff in Frank's music and timpanis. On this run, there's a ton of timpani stuff.
Interesting.
So I have timpani samples for most of the time on this run. And then cymbals, it's all Sabian stuff. And I have, it's kind of a combination of HHX and Paragon and a couple of prototype things, but hats, crash on the left, crash on the right, crash on the far right. I have a Paragon China.
Get the Neil Peart thing in
there. Totally had to, right? Uh-huh. And then I have a stack that's a 20-inch Paragon China with a radio, which is the Bozio line, the radio splash on the inside of it, and then a little radio bell and a Paragon splash.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of effects stuff, which, and mind you, before this gig, I've been 4-piece guy my whole life. And it took a while to get used to this. And I'm being dead serious. Like, mm-hmm. It took a while. And I have a double pedal. It took a while getting used to this spacing of having three rack toms when you have one your whole life. So, you know, it was definitely a growing experience. And now it's funny, when I get off this gig and go home and go back to four piece, I miss stuff.
Oh yeah.
I'll go to hit something. Cause generally if I just hit, you know, lower one of my arms on this kit, I'll hit something.
Right.
Cause there's so much stuff to hit, but I go home and people will laugh at me on gigs. I'll just whiff on stuff all the time because I'm used to this kit.
Oh, I'm a four piece guy also. Yeah. And in the occasional time wherever if I'm playing like a backline provided gig or just a gig, you know, where the drums are already set up.
Yeah.
Sometimes that extra tom-tom, it just feels weird. It feels like it gets in the way. So I completely get it. And then having to go back to the four piece, that's interesting, man.
Yeah. And then we'll be off the road for a couple months. And I'll go back to this. And then it takes like a week to get used to this again. But muscle memory is an amazing thing. And muscle memory takes over pretty fast.
Are you using DW hardware and pedals as well?
Yes. Yeah. All DW hardware, 9000 series double bass drum pedal and hi-hat. Stand, yeah.
But sticks.
ProMark 5A Hickory wood tip.
Interesting.
So I've
a little smaller than I thought you might use.
So there's a good story for that. It's interesting you mentioned that. So I've been 5B guy like my whole life. So I got this gig and our sound man and I started talking one day and I never really had put a lot of thought into how loud different sticks can make drums sound in the house. And he had suggested using smaller sticks because, you know, you play different size rooms. And I'd always thought of it from a jazz versus rock standpoint or, you know, from a stylistic standpoint, but never from a volume thing. I never thought there'd be that big of a difference. So I grabbed some 5As, I grabbed some 7As, I grabbed a whole bunch of different ones just to kind of see what would happen. And he would notice a remarkable difference.
Going to the smaller stick, though, from 5Bs, do you feel like you have a tendency then to overplay, though?
No. I break more sticks.
Okay.
Because, you know, the Frank catalog has so many different styles of music.
Yeah.
So there's stuff that's very delicate, and there's stuff that's not. Like, you know, Bozio, you know, wailing. So sometimes I will switch and go to like one song. I'll grab a pair of 5Bs. But honestly, I'm so used to using the 5As now that the 5Bs seem huge. When I go home and do like original Rock Band gigs, I go back to 5Bs.
Gotcha.
But I don't feel like I overplay, but it definitely took a while to get used to. And for a while I would use different size sticks for different size rooms. And now I pretty much just use 5As all the time.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so now we have gotten up to the point of talking about the gig that you're on tonight.
Yeah.
First, and I think everybody's going to find this interesting, how did you hear about this gig? Because we've talked about auditioning before, and it is the audition process for anyone with the last name Zappa is legendary.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear about how you heard about this gig, and then tell us how you kind of got involved with it, with like an audition.
So when I mentioned this a little bit ago, when I moved to LA and I went to Guitar Center and Simon Phillips was playing next door and I went to this club and sat at the bar and met these three people. So that was in 99. Crazy enough, one of those people was in the band Green Jello at the time. And he was like, what are you doing tomorrow? This is the first day I lived in LA. I was like, nothing. I don't know anybody. I don't have any work. Yeah, you know, nothing. He said, well, there's a big party at the Green Jello compound. You should come. So I went to this party and I met this guy there named Pete Jones, who is now the tour manager for Dweezil. But this was in 99, way before any of this. Dweezil started this in 06. So Pete and I became great friends and he's had a bunch of bands. I played in his bands and he had a house jam session. I was the drummer in his house jam session. And we listened to the same style of music, both diehard Frank fans, and we hit it off. So we're friends. From like the second day I lived in LA. So he calls me in 06 and he's like, you're not going to believe this. Dweezil's starting this project playing his dad's music. And I knew immediately Joe Travers was going to be the drummer because Joe has played with Dweezil forever and Joe's incredible.
This is the guy that's also, he's the archivist as well.
Yeah,
right?
He's the vault meister. Uh-huh, yeah, and he's an amazing, amazing guy. And one of my favorite drummers in LA. And I knew it was going to be him. And Pete had some mutual friends, this friend of ours, Ed Cannon, who was drum teching for him. And then about a year later or so, something like that, then Pete got called to work for Dweezil also. Mm-hmm. And when Pete got called to work for him, I said from day one, this is probably like in 07, I said, if he'll never quit. Joe will never quit. He'll always be there. But if something ever happens, you have to call me.
Yeah.
Because I'm a diehard fan. I was like, and Pete was like, oh yeah. But you know, we were both like, well, that'll never happen. Of course, that'll never happen. Why would that happen? So I started going to shows. I probably saw the band 15 times before I actually got in the band because I'm just a huge fan. So in, let's see, February of 2013, my phone rings and it's Pete. I look down, I see it's him. I answer. He doesn't even say hi. He says, Ryan. And I was like, yeah. And he says, it's time. And I was like, are you? I knew what he meant. I said, yeah. Are you serious? He said, yes. I said, you got to be kidding me. And I said, what do I need to do? He said, I need you to film yourself playing two really hard Frank songs. Doesn't matter what it is, anything, right now. I need it right now. If you want a chance, I need it now. Clearly, I'm not totally ready to just like go next door and like blast this stuff out. So I was at MI when I got the call. So there was a student there named Mike Sassano, one of my students, and he was shooting YouTube videos for all the students at MI. So I grabbed him in the hall. I said, Mike, you can't tell anybody about this. I'll pay you anything you want. I kept thinking I need like a day to practice at least, but you know, there was no time. Back to my point of auditioning earlier. Right. So I said, will you do this? And he said, of course I'll do it. I said, let's meet tomorrow at midnight. You know, there won't be that many people here at MI. I'll shoot it at MI. He was like, no problem. So Mission Impossible style, like we meet in a room the next day at midnight.
Yeah.
I basically don't sleep that night. And I picked Inca Roads and the Black Page number two. And the Black Page number two I did on my recital in Indiana. So I already knew it. It'd been a long time since I played it, but it was in the, you know, it was back in my mind. I could kind of download it from my mental cloud, so to speak.
Yeah.
Inca Roads, I just picked. I was just like, well, sure, why not? It has to be something hard. So my friend Mike videos this stuff. I send it to Pete. Pete sends it to Dweezil. Dweezil calls me the next day. It was like, boom, boom, boom. That fast. And then when Dweezil called me.
He called you, not management. He called you.
He called me.
Okay.
Yeah. Because Pete sent him the videos. He watched the videos. And there had been like some long screening process like up to this point. So then it was about an hour long interview on the phone. And what I gathered, and I'll tell you now that I didn't realize in the moment, was that, you know, he wants somebody in his band that loves his dad's music. And I've worshiped his dad's music since I was a little kid, since I was 13. And so immediately he was like, tell me about my dad's music. Who played drums on One Size Fits All? Tell me about Chester Thompson. What's your favorite thing about Bozio? What records did Bozio play on? What records did Vinny play on? What's your favorite Ainsley Dunbar song? Who's Jimmy Carl Black? Like, this went on for about an hour. And I felt like I'd been preparing for this my whole life because I've just been a massive fan my whole life. And my whole life, thanks to all my teachers and going to Indiana, had been studying orchestral jazz and rock and Latin and all this stuff my whole life. So I felt like everything had been leading to kind of this one moment of like all styles. Somehow this is maybe going to happen. So at the end of the conversation, he said, I want to play. I said, awesome. I said, when? He said, well, how about this day? We pick this day. It's about 3 weeks out.
Yeah.
I said, what songs are you going to do? He said, I'll email you. Give me your email address. I give it to him. Nothing. It's like 3 weeks away. Now, for those of you that I bet a lot of you know, there's about 100 records now. You know, when he was alive, he released, you know, like 70 or whatever.
Right.
I don't know where to start. There's so many. He could pick, you know, 10 of the most random songs ever. I don't know what's going to happen. So I didn't even know where to start practicing. So I started kind of listening to everything all the time, you know, but not really playing anything, just kind of getting it loaded into my head. And then about a week before, I'm thinking, man, I really should probably email him. Maybe he forgot to email me the list. Maybe I didn't get it. Maybe I gave him the wrong email address. I'm like, all this shit's going through my head. And finally, about 36 hours before, I was just like, I've got to email him. So I emailed him. I said, hey, really sorry to bother you. Any chance you could please send me that list of songs? He's like, hey, sure, I'll send it tomorrow. Like, he sends it tomorrow. So I basically had 48 hours notice.
Yeah.
For these insane songs. So I looked at my wife and I got the email. I was like, all right, I'll see you in 48 hours. And I went to MI and I basically didn't sleep for 48 hours. Like, I have one shot at this. I've worked at this my whole life. I'm going to nail this as much as I can on 48 hours notice. And I've been against, not just for me personally, I've always been anti slowdowner apps.
Yeah.
I bought a slowdowner app for one song from Mogio in particular, because it's just insane. And then I realized later that he would know that if I was BSing him on the phone conversation and on the video, that if I could go in and somehow fake my way through these 10 insane songs on 48 hours notice, that he'd know at least I did have some idea of what was going on. So then I went in and played.
So, man, you got the call. You talked to Dweezil for a little while. And then he wanted to hear you play. You know, so, I mean, because you gave him the right answers, you know, for what he was looking for. So, again, the Zappa, auditions are legendary. So tell me about when you went to go meet him to play.
So it was at a rehearsal studio in L.A. in North Hollywood. And he'd send me this list of 10 songs. So we run through the 10 tunes. And then it was kind of a drop the needle thing. It was, hey, let's do this song again, but start it from the second chorus. Ready, count it off, go. Hey, let's do this song. Let's start it from the bridge. Ready, go. And he kind of wanted to, I knew immediately. He was like testing my knowledge of the forms of the songs. Which goes back to what I was talking about earlier with charting and knowing forms.
Did you do that? Did you make some little notes for this?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
I did, but I know the songs so well just from knowing them forever. There were only I think two that I actually used. Mogio, because it's insane.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think there was one, I'd have to look at the list, to be honest, to see what the other one was. I think there was one other one that I did. But the other ones I just had from memory, and I'm so used to charting stuff. I did make quick charts of all of them, of all the 10, but then just kind of internalized it because I know the forms. It was just more of a part thing. So it was kind of a drop the needle thing like that on those songs. And I had been up for about 48 hours straight. And even though I've done a million auditions, because this was like, for me, the one.
Right.
This was for me, this was like the end all. It was like this or like replace Neil and Rush.
You know? Yeah, right. Yeah.
And we all know that's never happening, especially now. And so this is it. And so I was actually nervous, and I never get nervous. Like, and I was, you know, even though I'd done all the prep, which makes me wonder what would have happened if I hadn't done any prep over the last 10 years. Seriously.
Yeah.
So at one point, it was actually funny. Sheila Gonzalez in the band, she actually said probably after like the third song, she was like, Ryan, and I had met her 10 years before, but she didn't remember me. You know?
Yeah.
She said, Ryan. I said, yeah. And she goes, take a deep breath. Which now we laugh about.
That's funny. Yeah.
Now it's hilarious. In the moment, I was like, oh no, they know I'm really nervous. Oh no. You know, it's not like,
yeah. Yeah.
But it's just so much material into it. And it's so close to me because I love it so much. And I didn't want to mess it up. And I hadn't mentioned this before. I'm also a diehard Dweezil fan.
Oh yeah.
And I have all of his stuff. I played along with all of his stuff, and his record Confessions is one of my favorite records ever. Josh Fries played on it when he was like 17. So it went really well. It was not what I wanted it to be, but it went great. It was.
How long did it last?
It was long. It was probably about an hour plus.
Wow. Okay.
It was long. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a heck of an audition.
Like, man. I definitely know it. You know, I give myself maybe on the first day like a B plus. You know, not an A or not A minus, A or A plus. But, you know, I was like, okay. You know, and when I left, I thought, well, that was awesome. I got to play with the Zappa Play Zappa guys. That was incredible. I got to meet Dweezil. That's probably it. You know, in my mind, I was like, cool. I didn't, you know, it wasn't what I thought it was.
Yeah.
So there was another guy that went after me. I'm not going to say his name, but he's a good friend of mine. And he went, he's a phenomenal drummer. And I didn't know he was auditioning. And at the time, he's a friend of a friend. I didn't know him that well yet. I saw that it was him and I was like, oh, he's got it. He's going to get it.
Yeah.
So he goes after me and we talk in the parking lot on the way out. Now, what neither of us knew is that it had been screened to the point where it was just two of us playing. There was like a massive pre-screening process.
Okay.
Of talking to people, friends, and getting recommendations, and the videos being sent in, and the phone conversation that only two of us actually played. So he went. Then the next day, Dweezil called me and said, "Hey, great job. I want to have a call back. You're both going to come back."
Okay.
I said, "Okay, awesome." And then my confidence kind of went back up. I was like, "All right." I was like, "I got this. I can take this now." Okay. You know what I mean? So then he added a couple of songs. He added City of Tiny Lights, and I'd have to look and see what on the first audition though. It was Montana, Packard Goose, the Peaches, and Regalia. I have the list. I'd have to look at it. I still have it as a playlist in my iTunes somewhere. So we went, and the second audition was at Sheila's house. The callback was there on Easter Sunday. And it was reverse order. The other guy, who's amazing, went first, and then I went second. And it was the same way as the first day. Did the same songs plus the new ones, the drop the needle thing, start this song from here. And then it was, okay, let's do this one, but when we get to this solo section, now make the solo section reggae.
Gotcha.
Now let's do this song. We get to the solo section, make the solo section jazz. One of the songs that was not on the list was The Black Page. And he said, "Do you know The Black Page?" And I did, because I'd learned it forever. He was like, "Play it." And I was ready for that. I figured he might ask me to do it. So I played it on a 4-piece kit.
Okay.
It was funny. I remember him saying, "This was awesome." He said, "Wow, that sounds like Buddy Rich playing The Black Page." Yeah. It was on a little 4-piece kit.
Yeah.
And then after that, then he started doing this thing that I know his dad did too. He would play a pattern. He'd say, "I'm not going to tell you what it is. When you figure out what it is, play with me." And he'd just play some guitar line in, 15, 16 or whatever, pick whatever it was. And I didn't know what was going to happen.
Right.
And then he'd do another one. And then he'd do another one. And then he'd get to one and then I'd jump in with him. And he'd say, "Okay, do it again. Same one, but play it reggae. Now do it again, but play it jazz. Now do it again, but play it country." And he started going through all these styles. It goes all back to the styles thing, especially with Frank. So it was kind of to see what would happen, like, improv wise. And then after all that, then he said, "Okay, do you think you can do this?" He said, if we're going to do Sinister Footwear, or we're going to do, insert insane song here, can you do it? And I was like, "Yes, I can." And then about 3 weeks went by, nothing. And I thought, I didn't get it.
Yeah.
And then I got the call.
So that's the next thing I want to ask you. You get the call.
Yeah.
Who calls?
Dweezil. Dweezil called. I looked down at my phone. I saw it was him, but so much time had passed. I thought, oh, he's just,
Yeah.
It's just, he's a super nice guy. I thought, it was just a courtesy call. But no, he called and told me.
So we know you accepted.
I did.
Right. Right. You're like, yeah, I want the gig. Now let's talk about nuts and bolts. Let's talk a little bit about nuts and bolts. All right. Dweezil was good enough to, make all the contact with you, about, yeah, hey, we want you to come in and audition, and then give you the call to say, hey, we want you to do the gig. Well, there's the old, there's the elephant in the room. How do we get paid? What's the pay for these things? What's pay for audition, or what's pay for rehearsal? What's pay for the gig? Did he talk to you about that, or was that a management thing? And how did you negotiate?
You know what? And that is one of the best questions ever. And it never came up. And I never asked. And to be honest, it never even occurred to me, because I was so so excited to have. Yeah. To be like the guy to like kind of carry the torch, that it never occurred to me to ask that until way later.
Yeah.
Like months later.
Were you into the gig, like not auditioning, but rehearsing at that time?
Yes. Wow. Yeah. Okay. We were like, it was once we started, like we started rehearsing, we were probably, and that was, so I got the gig in April and we started rehearsing in, I want to say late June or July.
Mm-hmm.
And we started rehearsing, and that's when I was like, oh, wait, maybe I should find that out.
Right.
So that's then when I asked, and then there was a management thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah. 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 And that's a great question, because nobody talks about that. And we talk about that at MI also.
Yeah.
And every gig is totally different.
Right.
And depends on if it's a road gig or in town, and if there's a label or not a label. And
it's a super touchy subject,
yeah,
that everyone has to deal with though, at one time or another. And so it's important to know, you know, just how hands-on some of these, you know, how some of the artists are versus how much, you know, you actually never deal with them, you know, and only deal with management,
yeah,
you know, for that sort of thing. So it sounded like you got everything worked out with management.
We got that worked out. As a side note, just because that's such a great point. I talk about this with students at MI all the time. And I'm very open with them, and I tell them like real numbers, just because people, because right. How else are you going to know? Like, no one's going to know, and you're not going to know. Like, it's easy to say, oh, well, negotiate. Well, negotiate for what? If you don't know, like, you don't have any basis. So that's, you know, early on, I called Kenny and I talked to Bizanette about it and was just like, you know, I don't want to know what you make on X gig, but on Y gig, you know, what do you think I should make? You know, just to have some sort of ballpark figure, like, and that's a huge thing.
It is, and one of the things that I tell my students also when it comes to negotiating, that sometimes you get to a point to where there legitimately is just, you know, this is what it is pay wise, and we can't go any more monetarily. But there are times that you can work things out also that's not necessarily monetary gains as well. You can, you know, if you're traveling on the road, sometimes you can negotiate hotel rooms, you can negotiate other kinds of food, you can add things in on per diems, you know, and that type of thing as well. Did you do anything with that? In other words, did you negotiate any type of non-monetary?
I did not with this gig, but I have on many other gigs.
Right.
Because this gig was cool the way it was. The way it was set up, it was great. So I'm very lucky for that. But on other gigs, yes. And another thing, you made me think of a bunch of stuff, like endorsement deals. Like, certain gigs could lead to endorsement deals, which then saves you a ton of money, which in effect is like another way of getting paid. So, a really good friend of mine told me this one time. Any gig you do has to have two of the following three things. It has to be amazing music, involve amazing people, or pay a crap ton of money.
Yep.
And he said, you'll never find a gig that has all three. But if you have one that has, only do a gig that has two, never do a gig that only has one.
Yeah.
Because if the people are not cool to be with and the music's not cool, but you're making a lot of money, it's not worth the money.
Yeah.
You know, you can go through all the kinds of scenarios with all that. So that, you know, but the negotiating thing is just such a great point. And there's ways to get, you know, you'll get some gigs you'll get press out of, which is, you know, you'll get other things that might not be of strict monetary value, but will be of value, you know.
Certainly. So now you're on the gig and you know there's going to be some dates coming up. Once again, the Zappa rehearsal schedules have been just absolutely infamous. Talk to us about when you start rehearsing for gigs.
Yeah, so with that first run, we rehearsed 26 days, and it's 7 hours a day. There's an hour for lunch, so you're playing for 6 hours. So it's from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., basically a one-hour lunch break in the middle. So you're playing, but you're playing the whole time.
Yeah.
So it was 26 days and it was broken up into like three chunks of time, kind of based around when Dweezil could do it with his schedule. And since then, it's usually been around that.
Right.
It's usually been like around the neighborhood of a month.
Is Dweezil present at all of them, or does he let you guys work things out and then he comes in at a later time?
It depends on what he has going on schedule-wise. But he's there a lot of the time, or if he's not with us, he'll be at home working on getting guitar sounds at home.
Yeah.
and practicing parts of Home while we kind of get everything together, or he'll be there. When I did my first run, he was there every day for all 26 of those days.
Yeah.
But he does the Experience Hendrix tour also. So sometimes, you know, he might be prepping for another tour or be out with something else.
Gotcha. Does he have an MD for the band, so to speak, or does he do it?
Yeah, there's not like an official MD. Sheila Gonzalez is the other original member of the band, along with Dweezil. So when he's not there, she is kind of the de facto MD. Mm-hmm. Because she's been around for the last 11 years since day one.
Gotcha. Okay. So now we're through the rehearsal process. Mm-hmm. 26 grueling days, but you guys are going to be razor honed. Should be really sharp then at that time. So it's time to go on the road. Okay. Now, for people who haven't been on the road for extended periods of time, or really who haven't ever been on the road, talk to me about a gig day. Like, in other words, what happens from the minute you hit the road, like in the morning, all the way up until sound check, through the gig, afterward, on to the next city.
Yeah, so we live on a bus. There's a bus that sleeps 12. Right now there's 11 of us that are on the bus. Mm-hmm. So the way, like, the first tour worked, and all subsequent tours, but the first one for me, I flew to Boston. We all flew to Boston. The bus picked us up at the airport. Mm-hmm. And then you're on the bus.
Yeah.
For like the next 2 months. So the run we're on right now is 6.5 weeks, 38 shows in 45 days. And you're on the bus the whole time. And you wake up pretty much whenever you want. So for being in the band, the first thing we have to do is sound check, which is usually about 5:30. Mm-hmm. So I have Chris, my tech, who is amazing. So I don't have to do anything till 5:30. Now, I figured out early on what I did. And this was a total conscious decision. I flip my body clock when I get out here.
Okay.
So I go to bed insanely late and then wake up at like 3, so that when the show is on, for my body, it's like midday. Because we play for like 2 hours, 45 minutes to 3 hours straight, no break.
No, not two sets, one long set.
One long set.
Uh-huh.
So it took me a while to kind of figure that out, but that's worked really well for me to kind of flip my body clock. But I have a 5-year-old, so when I go home, it takes me a long time to flip it back.
Yeah. And on top of it, you're dealing with multiple time zones also. If you go from LA to Boston, well, there's already a 3-hour difference.
You're right. Yep. So normal day. So I'll wake up like about 3 o'clock, walk around. I love being outside and walking. So I'll go around and walk for like an hour, grab some lunch somewhere, go to sound check. Get ready for the gig, play the gig, and then we're on the bus, so we shower in the venue. Mm-hmm. So I shower. I'm the one that showers after the show, mm-hmm. as probably everybody listening would also, because we're always drenched in sweat after show.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I shower afterwards. We do an autograph signing after most shows. And then we usually don't leave. It depends on how long the drive is to the next gig. Like last night, we left at 1 a.m. because it was a long drive. The night before, it wasn't until like 4 a.m. So then we'll try and find some like late night place that's open, go hang out there, have some dinner, you know, and then, you know, call the family, check emails, go to bed, wake up, repeat. And the whole goodnight Cleveland when you're in Detroit thing is 100% real, because you have no idea where you are. You don't know what day of the week it is. Mm-hmm. You have no idea what's going on.
I have used the term several times that being on the road, especially for any extended period of time, is suspended reality.
Yeah, it is. It mm-hmm. is like, all of us are away from our families, or away, you know, away from someone. Mm-hmm. And that's a great way to put it. We moved into a new house, and since we moved into the new house, I've literally been there half the time. So when I go home, it feels like life stopped and starts up again when I get home. But guess what? It didn't.
Right.
you know what I mean? Exactly.
So
it's weird. It's weird. The only way it's one of those things until you live it, you can't really explain it or feel it until you do it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's one of those things that you know, we as sidemen, we're not stars, so to speak. So we still have to pay the DirecTV bill and the other stuff. It doesn't matter. You know, we're still on the road. That stuff still has to be taken care of. We don't have our handlers do that, you know.
I did it last night on the bus.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
exactly. So just a couple of other quick things about the gig day.
Yeah.
All right. It's some real drummer stuff here. Do you, before either sound check or after sound check and before the gig, do you do any warming up? Do you have practice pads or anything like that?
So I do not, but I stretch and I walk. That's part of my thing for walking is I get out and stretch, walk around, and I have a foam roller. I got way into the foam roller. If you guys don't know what that is out there, you can go to your local sporting goods store and get one, and it comes with a nice DVD, and it'll show you what to do. So I bring one on the road, and I roll out my legs on the side, like my IT band, and because when you play nonstop, like every day, like it really starts to take its toll, you know, on you. And, you know, you hear, so I remember reading stories about that when I was a kid in magazines and being like, oh, that's a joke. That's not true. It's true.
Yeah. Well, so, and also even the greatest tour buses, I mean, the bunks, you know, and whatnot, you know.
Yeah. I did not sleep well last night. That's a good, every state has different road conditions and depends on how bumpy the roads are. And you know what I mean? It's like and I have a long history of tendonitis. And so going back to when I was 19, and I'm totally fine, but I'm very aware of my past, even though it was half my life ago. And so I just stretch a lot. I just have a lot of stretch. I've been doing it while we've been sitting here.
I've been doing
some hand stuff. And then the foam roller is great. But I don't warm up because we do sound check, which kind of eases me into it. And then when the show starts, the way this show we're doing right now starts, it eases me into it. So by the time I have to do insane, crazy, fast stuff, I'm warmed up. Last tour, we did One Size Fits All front to back every night, opening with Inca Roads every night.
Yeah.
I had to.
Right.
I had to warm up on a pad. Otherwise, my right hand might have fallen off my body at this point.
Sure. So your warm up for something like that, is it just rudimental stuff, or is it more like gig based song stuff that you might be warming up?
My thing is always the go to Kenny Aronoff 13 hand patterns, which is the 13 hand patterns from Stick Control. Stick Control, just various tempos, just to get blood flowing. And this is something else you might not think about, is what the temperature is where you are.
Yeah.
You know, like right now it's 70 degrees outside, but like we started a tour one time in January in Canada, and it's like, you know, 15 below zero.
Right.
Then I'm definitely warming up because my hands are like icicles. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And then I'm trying to play, you try to play it all, let alone try and play some crazy Frank song with the icicle fingers. It doesn't work. So yeah, it's a great question. It's a, I guess, sort of an involved answer. It depends on what the set list is, where I am, you know, kind of how I'm feeling. But right this tour now, no, I'm not warming up before.
On this particular run of dates that you're doing, how consistent is the set list?
This tour is very consistent because we have two new members in the band. And so we're working them into learning more songs. Before, it could change drastically, just because everybody knew more songs. So we'll get back to that point for sure. But right now, and it's the way I was when I got in the band. It was like, you know, I knew these 40 songs or whatever, and then slowly at soundcheck, we'll learn some more and bump up that number. So, which is actually another good point. Like at soundcheck, we run new songs. It's not just soundcheck, it's a rehearsal.
Right.
So like yesterday we ran I'm the Slime, which the two new members of the band had never played before until yesterday. So we're like, just, it's a good way to constantly add repertoire and keep it fresh, and, you know, keep it fresh. There's a lot of fans that follow us around, diehard Frank fans. So it keeps it fresh for them too. You hear some new songs here and there. If we play two cities close to each other, then we can swap stuff out. So a lot of people come to both shows, they get a different set list.
Yeah. That's cool, man.
But right now it's more tied down just because of new members. That's the only reason why.
So it goes without saying that you are, man, part of a lineage of just amazing Hall of Fame style drummers, man. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, now, no pressure.
No pressure, right?
Yeah.
So Have you had to play gigs in front of any of these guys? Like, let's say, let me just read off some of the names. Either like Ralph Humphrey.
Not Ralph yet.
Or Chester Thompson.
Yes.
Oh, in front of Chester. And what about Bozio or Caliuta?
Vinny, yes.
Wow.
Bozio, no. But I hung out with him a couple of weeks ago and helped him set up his drum set in Milwaukee. That's a sentence I never thought I'd say.
Well, no kidding. Don't want to take you a half day for you guys to set up.
Yeah, it was crazy with Vic Salazar from Vic's Drum Shop in Chicago. I was helping him. But Chester and Vinny. Yeah, no pressure, right? Yeah, like sitting in front of Chester playing front to back a whole record that he played on while he's sitting like where you are from me right now, just watching me.
How do you deal with that? How do you, that is surreal. How do you wrap your mind around
it? Insane. It's insane. And like the Vinny, and like we're sound checking with Vinny in LA, and I look over and our tour manager's like waving his hands in there. I'm trying to figure out what Pete is. I'm like, what is he doing over there? And he points down and Vinny's air drumming to me playing Zombie Woof.
Wow.
And I literally, the first thing went through my mind was, I can die now. I was like, what is happening? That's a great question. I will say it's more nerve-wracking to play with people that sit in with us. And now I've been doing it for 3.5 years. I've done, tonnight's my show 266. Uh-huh. Not that I'm counting. I count. If you have a gather, I like numbers. But it was more nerve-wracking, like the first time that like Eric Johnson sat in and played with us, you know, because then you're involved with them, you know, whereas Chester, it was, I almost felt like it was an honor to play it in front of him more than being freaked out by it. I more was just like, you are incredible. And I thank you for creating this and I get to do this and you're here and this is amazing.
Well, I mentioned to you before we ever started the interview that I saw a video of you guys the other night. And you know what? There's something I neglected to mention to you. And this will let you will know immediately what city it was in. Ike Willis was actually on the stage with you guys.
Chicago.
It was Chicago then.
Or he did Chicago and New York. But New York was just like 4 or 5 days ago.
That had to be quite the thrill, if not nerve-wracking as well, to have Ike Willis with you as well.
That was amazing. We did a couple of days of rehearsal in L.A., and I closed my eyes, and my brain went to year 16 playing with Joe's Garage in your parents' basement, and then I opened my eyes and was like, oh, my God, no, he's sitting in front of me.
Yeah,
like that. Like, that's a good example. Like, that was, you know, more like I can never mess up ever, but I can't let him down playing with him versus somebody watching, I guess.
Yeah. It's got to be inevitable that in your mind, he's thinking when you're talking about playing like some of the Joe's Garage stuff, he's got to be, you're thinking that he's got to be thinking, that's not the way Vinny did it.
We actually talked about that. There's the other side of the equation that Vinny is God.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So what is the hardest part of this gig?
Wow.
There's an easy question for you, huh?
Wow. No one has ever asked me that before. You know, the hardest, it's probably going to surprise everybody. The hardest part is probably being away from my wife and daughter.
I totally understand.
That's the hard, and thank God for FaceTime and Skype. And I don't know how people did it before. But and that's one thing for people listening that haven't done it, they're thinking about doing road stuff. Like, we're on this run of 6.5 weeks. I missed my wife's birthday, my daughter's 5th birthday, my wife and my 12th anniversary, Halloween. Mm-hmm. So you need to be prepared, and your partner needs to be prepared for you to be gone and miss everything and make it up when you get home. Mm-hmm. And I know, and I'm sure you do too, numerous people who have quit gigs because of that and have dropped out of the industry because of that or have gotten divorced because of that. And that's a huge thing that has nothing clearly to do with paradiddles. You know, it's just a lifestyle.
Oh, it's a real part of the gig, man. It's a lifestyle thing. Real part of the gig.
Yeah. as far as the actual gig part goes, for it's just such an honor to keep the music alive, and to play with Dweezil and play with this band is incredible.
Yeah.
And to play this stuff every night, I pinch myself. I'm like, I get to do this. Like, I get to play, you know, I'm the slime tonight.
Well, you've got the right attitude, because let me tell you, any person who plays drums for a living, that in itself is the reward, you know, it really is.
It is. At the end of the day, why do we play? For me, it's because I love playing along with cassette tapes in my parents' basement. I've said that over and over, but like, that's why we all started playing on some level. And I don't ever think I will ever lose that feeling. And I don't ever want to lose that feeling.
Yeah.
Because for me, it's the most fun thing in the world. And then specifically this gig for me, playing this music is ridiculous. Where else can you play this? There's only a couple of bands that do this
Get paid for it
and I'm very lucky, because there's a lot of drummers, there's a lot of great drummers.
Yeah,
it's not like I'm the only guy that could be here. I'm I don't take that for granted either. There's definitely a little bit of luck involved, so.
Well, now a couple more things about the Zappa gig, and then we'll start wrapping some things up here. If you wanted to be selfish, all right, and if everything that we've talked about's not enough, if there was one song from the Zappa catalog that you would love to play, but you guys are just not doing it. Now, I don't want you to think about it too much. Don't think about it too much. What is the one song that you would like to play that you're not doing?
Ship Arriving Too Late to Save a Drowning Witch.
Oh, okay.
No question.
All right. Yeah.
Maybe someday.
Yeah. The krill, the plankton. Awesome, man. Well, look, I want to do something today. Man, Ryan, you've been a great sport. We've had a lot of fun. I thought about doing something kind of silly, because humor does belong in music, right?
Hell yeah, it does.
You know, let me tell you, I thought about doing something, and I wrote a little quick thing out here. I'm going to call it the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast Rorschach Test. And what I wanted to, I wrote out just 20 little quick questions. This is going to be rapid fire.
Okay. All right.
Beat the clock.
Yeah.
Some of it's going to be yes or no.
We're on ESPN now.
Right, exactly. Yeah, all right. And it's going to be kind of like, for lack of a better term, I might go Coke or Pepsi, and
then Coke.
Yeah, right, there you go. You're in Atlanta. You have to say that, right?
I didn't think about that. Okay. I have been to the museum before.
Yeah. Right. So we're gonna try to get this. These are 20 questions. Let's try to get them done in a minute.
Okay.
I'll even give you this. You can do one pass, because man, I'm already gonna tell you there's one tough one on here.
Oh no! All right.
Okay. Are you ready? We're gonna start the clock.
Okay.
Wood tip or nylon tip?
Wood tip.
Metal snare or wood snare?
Wood snare.
The Police or Sting?
The Police.
Bus or plane?
Bus, no question.
Bozio or Caliuta?
Oh, God. Bozio.
Dogs or cats?
Dogs.
Click track or nothing?
Nothing.
Barbecue, pork or beef?
Beef.
Underrated drummer?
Jerry Gaskill.
Marimba or Vibes?
Vibes.
PC or Mac?
Mac.
What's your favorite cymbal?
Sabian 18-inch HHX Stage Crash.
Nice. You have a name for your car?
No.
Elvin or Tony?
Oh, wow. Tony.
Here's a California question. Safeway or Ralph's?
Ralph's.
Traditional grip or match grip?
Match.
For your driving, drive like a granny or drive a getaway car?
Granny.
Hard cases or bags?
Hard cases.
Stocks or mutual funds?
Stocks.
One more California question. In-N-Out Burger or Sco's In-N-Out Chicken Burger. Waffles? Oh. All right. That, you know what? I normally send these questions to the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast think tank, but I'm going to say you passed on this.
That was amazing. Okay, now I have to go back. I have to go back quick to the Bozio Vinny thing.
Oh, don't overthink it. Don't overthink it.
I need to say why. Here's why. Because the first Zappa record I got was Live in New York. That's why my mind went there, because the first song I ever heard was Titties and Beer, and it was Bozio going crazy, and I was like, what is happening? Yeah. Clearly Vinny is awesome, but from the way I came up with it, the first guy I heard was Bozio.
Wow. So awesome, man. Good sport, man. I appreciate that. So we'll go ahead and wrap it up with just a few other just quick things, man.
I want to go to In-N-Out now, by the way.
Oh, I told you I was in LA not long ago. I made sure I went to both on the first day, man. I went to Roscoe's and In-N-Out Burger on the first day that I was there. So after you get done with this, just future plans, just rough idea.
Well, I love teaching.
I do too.
And I feel like at some point, you asked earlier about what I was going to do after school. I feel like at some point, I'll probably end up getting a master's degree. And who knows after that, but I honestly love it. And I've been on a leave of absence from MI for like the last like 3 quarters, something like that. And I miss it a lot. And I love it. And I would love to teach there, or and then you know, maybe get a master's, you know, and who knows, maybe eventually go back to Indiana and teach in Indiana, you know, when it's in 25 years or
awesome
or whatever it is. I feel like that's something that I just really, really love doing, that I could do forever.
Yeah,
you know, like if God forbid something happened physically and I couldn't play drums, you know, I can always do that, and I love it. And what's better than talking about drums? Clearly, that's what we've been doing for the last couple of hours.
2.5 hours, man. Yeah. And so, Ryan, also, do you have anything you want to promote, tell the folks about?
Well, if you want to get in touch with me, that would be awesome. Feel free to do so. My website is ryanbrowndrums.com. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. And it's Ryan Brown Drums. You can see a common theme here.
Yeah.
I'm on Facebook. Find me on Facebook. If anybody has any questions, feel free to write anytime. That's awesome. Yeah.
Great. And then we'll go ahead and wrap it up, man. Any sage advice you'd like to give our listeners out there, young musicians, working musicians?
Don't give up. Persistence. Don't let anybody tell you can't do it or that you won't make a living at it, because I've been doing it for a long time, and the people I've seen that have not given up have, it may have taken a while, but they've eventually found a way to make a living doing what they love, and not, you know, in the case of LA, a lot of people, you know, move to LA. Not many people are from LA.
Right.
And I've seen so many people come and go and come and go. And every time they leave, I think, man, if they just would have stayed another year, because they're so great and they're a great person. And I've seen a few people move back home and they're not as happy because they're at home and they're, you know, doing something they may not want to be doing. I just say, just do it. Just don't give up, and don't let anybody tell you can't do it.
Brother, thank you so much, man. I had no idea that we were going to go for 2.5 hours, but let me tell you, there's not 1 second of fluff in this. Man, I you know, the Drummers Weekly Groovecast listening audience greatly appreciate you. And I've only met you, I've known you for 3 hours, but man, I consider you a friend, man, a friend of the show.
Well, thank you. I want to interview you for 3 hours. I want to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, Phil, thank you for having me. This has been awesome. It's an honor to be asked to do it. I really appreciate it.
Oh.
It's been great to be here. And
man, my pleasure. And guys, let me tell you, I can tell you from firsthand experience, he's not lying when he says, you know, if you want to get in touch with him, he's a great guy, and he will be happy to get in touch with you and tell you everything about the Zappa gig and how to steal it away from him. So
it's called get a baseball bat and find me outside the venue and break my legs.
There you go. Well, Ryan, thanks again so much. The Groovecast and our listening audience greatly appreciate you. And go out and see this guy when he's out on the road. He's a wonderful guy.
Thanks, Phil. And everybody, thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. This has been awesome.
You got it. We'll see you guys next week for another new edition of the Groovecast. Take care. Bye-bye. There you go, folks. There's the full 2 episodes of the Ryan Brown interview. I sincerely hope you enjoyed it as much as I did and enjoyed actually conducting the interview. It was a real pleasure for this guy to sit down and take that much time out of his day when I know he was absolutely dead tired. He was right on the very end of about 6 weeks worth of touring at that time, and they had gone through some hardships on the road with some transportation issues, and then just the normal grueling days, as you heard when he was describing what it's like. So, again, a huge thanks to Ryan Brown. I'd also like to take a quick moment and give a big thanks to a power listener to the show and a good friend of mine, David Freeman, for facilitating the interview. Dave, thanks so much. We appreciate it. And lastly, just all the folks down at the Variety Playhouse and the management and the rest of the folks with the Dweezil Zappa crew, you guys were absolutely fantastic. We took up a whole lot of time and took up a good bit of space in that green room area downstairs at the Variety. So thanks to everyone involved. All right, that's it for this week. We will talk to you soon. You can always find us on your favorite podcast app, Google Play Podcast, iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean. Subscribe to us today. Get a brand new show every Monday. All right, until next Monday, we will see you soon.
Dandy day that cost you under a fin.